In 2012, over 6 million children under the age of 5 died around the world. That number has fallen significantly from over 12 million in 1990, but 18,000 under the age of 5 continue to die each day. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, was created in 1946 to provide emergency food and care to children that were affected by World War II. Today, it's one of several international agencies working worldwide to provide care and protection to children. Carol Stern is the president and CEO of the United States Fund for UNICEF, and she writes on what we can learn from children affected by war, crisis, and disaster in a new book called I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Carol Stern to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Typhoon Haiyan struck the Philippines just over a week ago. Is UNICEF involved in any of the relief efforts?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've been out hawking all day today. UNICEF has already airlifted 60 metric tons of emergency supplies, and working with the Philippines government and USAID actually was able to restore full water to the Tacloban area and the six districts around it over the weekend.
Because the New York Times is reporting that little or no aid is getting to inland locations in the Philippines, and we've been hearing that relief efforts in general have been a lot slower than one would hope. I've wondered, since there have been many other disasters, why aren't we better prepared when one hits?
You know, it's not always a matter of being prepared as much as it is the reality of what a disaster brings. And I think until you're on the ground, you don't fully comprehend that. You can't get through. There isn't a road. There isn't power. You can't communicate. These are remote areas with none of the resources that we are accustomed to having. And if you look in our own country, a year later at Sandy, Katrina, still not fully rebuilt. Now go to a developing nation. You know, I spent a lot of time in Haiti after the earthquake, and people were digging out their homes with a spoon. I mean, so the preparedness is not always the issue. It's the reality of what's happening.
When UNICEF goes into these places, are they focusing on the needs of the children who've been affected only?
Not only, but primarily. You know, and UNICEF, interestingly, it doesn't just go in the wake of the emergency. We're there yesterday, today, tomorrow. We've been in the Philippines since the 1940s, Haiti since the 1940s as well. So one of the advantages is we're already on the ground. We're already established. We have a supply chain set up. We're that trusted neighbor. In Myanmar, we were the first ones actually to get to the disaster site because we were there on the ground and we had a warehouse and went right to work. First and foremost, UNICEF recognizes that children are the most vulnerable in the wake of an emergency.
Children and women, you say?
Children and women. In particular, children, though, in the immediate wake, because they're often separated from the grown-ups in their lives, and they don't have the maturity to seek the right help or to know who to trust to get it, and unfortunately, there are people who prey on them.
Officials in the Philippines have requested that money be donated rather than food, and we can see why sending teddy bears isn't going to be of much help. But why cash instead of food?
Often it costs more to ship the supply, and it takes longer to get it there than it does to have the dollars to source it close by.
And NPR reported just the other day that most U.S. aid gets shipped directly from the U.S. in the form of food. Is that because there are interests in this country that lobby for food to be sent more than cash?
Again,
money to be made?
As UNICEF doesn't follow that policy, UNICEF does actually maintain our own warehouses, ship to ourselves from ourselves. I can't really speak to what the purposes or issues or challenges may be for others. But for UNICEF, we do procure internationally. We have warehouses established around the globe, and we use the source closest.
How is the U.S. Fund for UNICEF connected to UNICEF? Does the U.S. Fund participate directly in the relief efforts?
The U.S. Fund is one of 35 what are called national committees. We're each independent organizations, not owned or operated by the United Nations. And we exist to support the work of UNICEF, to be the voice of children from around the globe, and then to educate the next generation about the issues confronting children.
And do you work with other agencies like the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees or the Red Cross?
We partner often with other organizations, again, as does UNICEF partner with those organizations.
You, as I said earlier, you've written that in emergencies, like famine or conflict, women and children are always the most vulnerable. Children are obviously unable to fend for themselves. Are there other factors making them more vulnerable?
Well, in most developing nations, there are no child registries. You don't have that birth certificate that proves who you belong to or that you're a citizen. So if you get separated from mom and dad, reunification is really difficult. And so children become victim to people who want to traffic them, want to sell them, force them into soldiering, all kinds of other things that happen because there is no proof of who they are or where they belong.
What about women? Why are they more vulnerable? Is that the result of gender inequalities?
Often it's the result of gender inequalities, not access to the same amount of supplies, not access to owning property or being able to fend for themselves.
Well, how can you be sure that aid gets to children when it has to be relayed to them by adults? We often hear about aid being skimmed by people in corrupt governments.
Well, again, UNICEF is unique because we ship from ourselves to ourselves. We're not shipping through the government and then to ourselves, but to ourselves. So you can, you know, I've literally written my name on a box in the States and seen that box in a warehouse in another country. And there's a very unique rotation system. About 50% of the staff in country are from that country, but the very top tier of the staff rotate every 3 years. So no one is really in country long enough or with the same people long enough to establish, you know, for lack of a better description, a black market.
Well, there have been reports of looting in the Philippines as people are growing desperate for food and shelter. And I wonder if some of this aid work isn't a bit dangerous.
I would imagine it is. I don't think I've been in any of the, you know, 40 countries I've visited since I joined UNICEF, the UNICEF family, where there hasn't been some sense of danger for the staff who live on the ground. They are still the invited guests. They're not residents. They often give the impression that they may have what others have not. So, yeah, I'm sure there's risk.
And groups like Doctors Without Borders sometimes actually have to pull out of places where they're doing a lot of good simply because they can't protect the people who are doing the good work.
Absolutely. You know, and I have seen really in my 7 years with UNICEF some of the most fearless and the most selfless people. I mean, they are remarkable people who put their lives on the risk every single day just to help the world's children.
With the problems of the Obamacare rollout and now the crisis in the Philippines, Syria seems to pretty much have dropped out of the news. What's happening to the children there?
It's the biggest humanitarian crisis of our generation. I mean,
worse than the East Congo?
Yeah. The millionth child refugee just passed over the border a couple of weeks ago. You take a country like Jordan of 4 million that has accepted a million refugees, and you think about what's going to happen. And these children are not getting educated, and so there's an entire generation getting lost.
Is that the region that's most persistently in need? Or is there a reason that is?
It's hard-pressed to say who's the most consistently in need. You know, a week ago, the Philippines wouldn't have been on my chart. So I think that any place that a child goes to bed hungry, that a child goes to bed in danger, is the most in need. You know, and there isn't a pain war where you don't want to take food out of the mouth of a child here to give it to the child there. And therefore, we just have to step up and help all children. That's the theme of my book, I Believe in Zero.
And you also suggest that no matter how bad things are, children are always children. You mentioned that everywhere you've traveled, you've seen kids playing with some kind of ball. So kids manage to find ways to play even in the worst conditions?
Even in the worst conditions. I think the biggest lesson I've learned in my 7 years is the resiliency that children have, their sense of hope that even in the worst conditions, they'll make you laugh. You know, I talk about it. They always have a ball. Sometimes it's just rags tied with string, but they always have a ball. Or if I sit on the ground, they sit on me. You know, they just know they can. And they're never selfish with hugs or to make you laugh or to play a game. And you don't have to speak the same language. There's this kid speak, and they get it, and it's delicious.
And these are things that can't be learned from reviewing reports and data.
Absolutely. They can't be reviewed. The sheer tenacity of human spirit, not only in children but in general, is something that I just had not foreseen I would see before I started traveling on behalf of UNICEF.
How widely have you traveled?
over 40 countries, in my 7 years with UNICEF, from Vietnam to Darfur to Sierra Leone, Mozambique, Latin America, really all over the globe.
Carol M. Stern has spent more than 30 years in the nonprofit sector as a child advocate and civil rights activist, and since May 2007, she served as president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF. She's written a book called I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children, Zero Hunger, Zero Poverty, Zero Disease. It's published by St. Martin's Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Carol M. Stern, who is president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF. She's written a book called I Believe in Zero, and it is published by St. Martin's Press. I Believe in Zero is an odd title, but so let's talk about the I Believe in Zero campaign.
Sure. When I first came to the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, 26,000 children, were all under the age of five, were dying each day of causes we already knew how to prevent and just weren't doing the job.
So now it's down to 18,000. That's not so great.
Well, but in the 1930s, that number was around 35,000 every day. So we've halved the number. And in the ensuing time, the world's population has tripled. So theoretically, if we had done nothing, it could have been 90,000 dying each day. And when you think about that, it's a huge success story. It really is. And people have this perception that aid to developing nations is this black hole, you know, we can't seem to climb out of, yet there's been great progress.
Well, what's the I Believe in Zero campaign in relation to the UN's Millennium Development Goals? How does that work?
Well, the Millennium Development Goals brought the plight of poverty to the forefront and set some goals, objectives of where we were going to get. But at the U.S. Fund, we're not going to stop until the number of children dying each day of preventable causes is zero. That's our goal. Because, you know, I write about it in the book. I was in Sierra Leone. I held the hand of a mom who didn't speak English. Together, we watched her six-day-old baby die of tetanus. And I sat there and I thought, tetanus, this is a disease that in our country, you step on a nail, you get a tetanus shot. If God forbid your child contracted tetanus, a couple of bucks, you'd have the antibiotic, you'd all go home. And her child died. And the child contracted tetanus because she gave birth at home, cut the umbilical cord with a piece of metal, and the net result, tetanus. Unacceptable in the year 2013.
But then there are also situations where people are suspicious of medicine, as we've seen in places where they're actually killing doctors who administer polio shots.
There are definitely some who do, but the overwhelming majority are not. Again, it's part of why UNICEF is part of the community yesterday, today, tomorrow, so that people get to know the people employed, not just the product we produce, and relationships are formed.
Well, you talked about the things that are preventable, but hurricanes, earthquakes, droughts are not, at least until we start considering whether global warming is a real issue. But we'll get to that in a moment. Is it really possible to get mortality from natural disasters down to zero?
Do I believe I'll see zero in my lifetime? Most likely not. But can I set a goal for anything less than zero? No, because again, I looked in the eyes of a mom who had just lost a child, and I don't believe that it is acceptable for any child to die of something we could have prevented. So any less is not acceptable.
Things like vaccines, food, or clothing have benefits that are obvious. Are there kinds of assistance that are less obvious or that have surprising benefits?
Absolutely. First of all, education being, I think, the best tool in our arsenal for interrupting that whole cycle of poverty. And I've seen that in a couple of different ways. You know, the mom who can't read and write is hard-pressed to take care of a child, but the educated mom will be an educated child. The famine in the Horn of Africa, but people who have lived their whole life as nomadically taking their herd from one place to the next, well, when the drought comes and then the herd dies, they don't have an option. So you got to go in and you've got to teach people to read, to write, to open up their minds and to have opportunities beyond what their parents may have had. And I've seen amazing programs. You know, probably the one that impressed me the most, which is a really simple one on the education front, is taking place in Ethiopia right now. In the United States, we have Head Start and a lot of other programs that prep kids for school. And in the developing world, we saw that kids who live in a hut, who don't have TV, whose parents don't read, no one's read to them, they don't know numbers, colors, and they've never sat still for 20 minutes. And now they're going to school and they're not succeeding. So we put in place a program where 13-year-olds who have stayed in school now take one or two kids to their hut and teach them school readiness. It costs $7 a child to produce this program for a year, and the kids who have gone through that program are staying in school and succeeding. Phenomenal success.
There's been growing interest in recent years in new approaches like microfinance. Is UNICEF involved in any projects like that?
We've had some touching with microfinance, not ones that I've been directly involved with, so I really can't speak to personal experience with them, but I've borne witness to them in some of the countries I've been in.
How important is public awareness in wealthy countries like the United States when relief is needed? Disastrous acts of nature like the Fukushima earthquake or the Typhoon Haiyan get lots of attention, but do other kinds of crises tend to remain off the radar?
Absolutely. You know, I was actually quoted in the Times a couple of years ago saying, so find me the mountain. You know, what mountain do I have to stand on? How loud do I have to yell to get people to hear that 18,000 children are dying each day? They may not be dying right in front of your face, but they're dying nonetheless.
Well, how difficult is it to raise support when wealthy countries are in economic doldrums, as the United States has been now for 5 years?
Interestingly, the people who were hardest hit with the economy continued to support us. I have a box of letters that I pull out on a bad day of people saying, you know, we no longer eat beef in our house. We can't afford it. Here's my $10 for the children who aren't eating at all. I mean, just phenomenal letters. You know, the child in a developing nation is so far behind the eight ball of a child born in the U.S. The child in the U.S. has a birth certificate, developing nation, none. Child in the U.S. guaranteed an education. It's a right, not a privilege. Child in a developing nation, lucky if he gets one. Immunizations, you're going to get them in the U.S. You're not unless there's a program in a developing nation. So some very basic tenets. A child who's 13 years old and the parents die in the U.S., there is a social service system that will come to the aid of that child. Developing nation, that child becomes head of household.
So does UNICEF only provide assistance in developing countries?
Yes, except in extreme circumstances. So following Katrina, we were invited in by the United States and worked on the water plan and also did something called School in a Box. It's a suitcase with everything you need to keep school going when there is no school, and we used it in the shelters in Houston in particular.
In yesterday's New York Times, there was an article about how developing countries are criticizing the wealthier nations for reneging on commitments to mitigate climate change. So there are all sorts of other things that go on, and some countries like Japan are claiming, well, they're just they're constrained by tight budgets. The United States, we have the problem of sometimes a war within Congress and between the executive branch and Congress. And you have to navigate all of that?
We do, although the good news with UNICEF is we have no politics whatsoever. The only side we're on is the side of a child. And so, therefore, we work on both sides of every battle or all sides of every battle. UNICEF has brokered ceasefires to get immunization campaigns through. I mean, it's really quite fascinating.
Well, how is the political gridlock in Washington affecting your efforts?
It's affecting our efforts with regard to support for aid. Foreign aid for children has declined. It will continue to decline, it's projected. And so until the issues that confront our government are settled, I'm hard-pressed to get it to increase. Faith in the government declines, therefore people are not paying as close attention. You know, we've set as one of our goals to make child survival a campaign issue, to hear presidents and other leaders talking about it, to get people engaged around it. Hard when the government isn't at work.
A caller asked whether you can tell listeners how to donate to support aid to the Philippines, because there is concern that you give money to an organization and it just doesn't get there.
97 cents on the dollar given to UNICEF is going to the Philippines. You can give aid by going on our website, unicefusa.org. You also can text a $10 gift by texting the word RELIEF, R-E-L-I-E-F, to 864-233, or you can phone it in by calling 1-800-4KIDS, F-O-R-K-I-D-S.
My guest is Carol M. Stern. Her book, I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children, is published by St. Martin's Press. You write of traveling to Dubai in a group that included several business school alumni. On this show, not all that long ago, journalist David Rohde described a business school grad in Afghanistan who recommended techniques that are taught in business schools, but which didn't work on the ground. Is there a problem of Westerners imposing their ideological assumptions through aid programs?
I think the most effective aid programs are the ones that marry the cultural norms and the ideas of the people on the ground with the experience or expertise you might bring to the situation. It's hard to, people say, oh, well, they need computers, give them computers. Well, what good are computers if you have no power? You know, how are you going to charge them? What good is a charging station if the sun doesn't shine in that place for several months? You know, it's bigger problems than people sometimes can conceptualize. So you have to have people who have experience on the ground who understand what it is they're trying to achieve.
Agencies assisting Haiti after the 2010 earthquake were criticized for raising lots of money, about $5 billion, but then failing to deliver assistance. Have those issues been addressed?
Not by all. And again, I think there's a lesson there in what happened in Haiti. And as I was down in Haiti several times and shortly after the quake, and there were a lot of pop-up organizations, very, very good-intentioned people who came wanting to help but didn't have necessary skills and didn't have a supply chain, didn't have government relations, didn't have workers on the ground, so that a lot of dollars went into establishing the organization instead of serving the people.
And then there was an outbreak of cholera in Haiti. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control identified the strain as coming from South Asia, which suggested that people who've been brought in to help had actually brought the cholera with them. And the UN and the CDC initially opposed investigating how cholera was introduced to Haiti. Did UNICEF take a position on that investigation?
No, UNICEF did not.
The UN had a peacekeeping mission to Haiti before the 2010 earthquake, and that mission had been criticized. Is there a problem at times for you when the UN accountability is called into question?
Well, the letters UN start the name. So clearly, whatever the UN does, UNICEF is proud to be part of the UN. I think that what I have learned in my 7 years is what the advantages are to being part of the UN, regardless of its politics. Working with a government, being able to leverage the work that you do so that you're not building a school unless there will be teachers supplied, being able to insist that school fees be eliminated or the school won't get built at all, being able to work with the government to put in water plants and to put in water purification systems, not just going glass by glass, being part of a country plan so that you're not duplicating efforts with what someone else is doing. All of that is because UNICEF is part of the UN, and yet UNICEF will only exist as long as the will of the people want it to. It is not a part of the UN budget. It is supported by UN funds, but not in the annual operating budget.
Reports last week indicated that the median New York income is still 6% below what it was at the start of the recession in 2007. And one in five New Yorkers, that's 1.7 million people, live in poverty. Almost one in three children fall below the official poverty line, in fact. Is there anywhere in the United States where we could see problems similar to what you've seen in the poorest countries and developing nations?
There are some problems that are consistent. No child should go to bed hungry, regardless of where that child lives.
But Indian reservations almost are like third world countries, aren't they?
I can't speak from a first-hand experience, having not spent the time on the Indian reservations, but I can say that, again, in this country, there is the financial wherewithal to change some of that if the people make it happen. In the developing world, that's not the case.
Well, we're aware of the developing world. I think what I'm stressing now is that this seems to be a problem now that even is affecting other countries. UNICEF in Britain warned that budget cuts would increase deprivation for children there.
Absolutely. Again, whenever the economy goes down, children are still the most vulnerable, regardless of the depth of down it goes. So I would never try to say that one's pain is greater than the other. No child should go to bed hungry.
Well, the same UNICEF report that had some raising alarm in Britain ranked the United States 34th out of 35 countries in relative child poverty. We're just above Romania.
That's right.
So how did that happen in what we tend to think of as the wealthiest country in the world?
Because, again, most of the income of a country is an average of the have and have not, as opposed to a look at how those dollars are shared or leveraged or distributed is the word. That's the word I'm struggling for.
Well, you said you're apolitical, but there are political problems that affect places. UNICEF expressed concern about conditions for children in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories last November. How do you get past those kinds of tensions?
UNICEF also expressed concerns about children in a host of other countries when there was a study done on the way Palestinian children were treated in Israeli prisons, but there were also similar studies done in other countries. And that is the point, is we will always be on the side of the child, not the country.
And what's happening with child soldiers? Because that's a problem all over the world. After the war is over, those kids have to be integrated into a society. They are traumatized.
They have to be completely repatriated. And if you look at, there's a young man by the name of Ishmael Beya, another author.
If
you read his
book,
yeah, he's phenomenal. He is a UNICEF spokesperson. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking to him about what he's been through and how UNICEF was the program that pulled him out. It can be done, and it should be done. You know, no child would choose to be born into poverty. No child would choose to be forced into soldiering or the sex trades. And so when they fall victim to that, we as adults have a responsibility.
Carol M. Stern has spent more than 30 years in the nonprofit sector as a child advocate and civil rights activist. And since May 2007, she served as president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF. Her book, I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children, is published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much. And all proceeds from the book do go to UNICEF.